The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and on this week's program, Charles Arthur grills RIM Developer Relations Vice President Alex Saunders about what's going to happen now that the company looks, tragically, to be heading into hard times. And Jemima Kish speaks with Ian Hogarth about Songkick, the London-based music service that delivers everything you need to know about where and when your favorite band is playing, 3 years after we first heard about the company in the Tech Weekly studio. We'll also be speaking about the iPad mini launch, which is imminent. So keep listening to Tech Weekly from The Guardian for the latest technology news. First up, Charles, you've been covering the decline of RIM. Poor RIM. The company behind the BlackBerry handset for quite some time. Yeah, and
they were very big in 2010. They were, their shares hit a peak in sort of 2008, 2009, and then started heading down. It's really the Android eating away at it, sort of, and Apple taking the top, and Android devices eating away at the bottom, sort of like termites, basically.
How quickly, though, everything turns, because that's really not a huge amount of time.
It isn't, and they changed. It was actually only in January of 2012, this year, that they changed their chief executives. It used to be Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis, who are sort of co-founders of the company, and everyone suddenly realized that things had gone way wrong, and they put Torsten Hines, who's the chief operating officer, in charge instead. And the question becomes one of, well, can he turn it around fast enough?
Well, here's another question, and that is about what happens to the people who've been developing for BlackBerry. And you spoke with Alex Saunders, the RIM Developer Relations Vice President, about this particular subject. You're kind of tackling RIM from all angles, basically. Tell me what happened when you spoke with Alec.
Well, Alec has the interesting job, I guess you call it, of persuading all the people who are presently developing for BlackBerry's BlackBerry OS 6 and 7 of moving over to BlackBerry 10, which is their forthcoming version of their handset operating system. That's expected in some time in the first 3 months of 2013. Has been delayed because they really wanted to get all the things like the APIs, the developer interactions, all those sorts of things. They wanted to get them really locked down, really correct. But that meant that they were going to miss the Christmas season, which we're now in, which is a hard thing. He has the tricky job of persuading people to do that and also to migrate over and write from other platforms to pick up with BlackBerry to join in the whole RIM game, I guess you could call it, and make the platform more effective.
So what is his special sauce? I imagine this is what you spoke with him about.
His special sauce is some of it is money, actually. They've got a really interesting scheme to incentivize people to write stuff for BlackBerry, where you get paid up to $10,000 if you can sell $1,000 worth of stuff, and also a certain amount of charm, actually. So we all know that RIM has been having a fairly heavy time of it in the past year, and BB10 is the upcoming version of the operating system, which everyone is looking forward to. A lot of people are saying this is the great hope, this is what everything is being pinned on. What is there for users that they should be looking forward to on BB10, as opposed to the BlackBerry phones that are out there now, or indeed the other platforms?
I think BB10 is a fresh take on what a smartphone is. When I look at the BlackBerry 10 devices and the way the operating system works, we've done a ton of work on the gestural interface to make it completely natural. The entire experience is centered around the inbox, just as it would be on a BlackBerry. So first and foremost, these devices are communications focused, they're relationship focused, they're people focused. They're not necessarily the media centric version of the smartphone that the world has seen for the last 5 years. And I think that's both a fresh take on what a smartphone is, and it's also a profound difference from the way that people view smartphones today. And I think generally, anybody that we've shown this to has been pretty darn excited about what they've seen so far.
So it sounds like what Thorsten Heim was talking about earlier this year, where he was saying that there would be a refocus on the corporate customer, that that was the sort of the core user base, and that by making it focused around email, around tasks, around people, that you're really looking to refocus and recapture them.
Well, I hesitate to say that it's focused on corporate solely. Because when you think about it, we all do those things. I mean, BlackBerry people, for example, are 87% likely to send a social media message in a day versus 63% on other platforms. And we have a very, very strong consumer base as well. I mean, huge numbers of our customers are consumers. Amongst youth, BBM is the social network of choice when you start to talk about mobility. So really, the BlackBerry 10 devices are returning to a core set of values around communications and around interacting with relationships that matter to you that I think a lot of the world has forgotten about in the last 5 years.
Why do you think the world's forgotten that?
Well, we had the introduction of the iPhone, right? And what that was the marriage of a media device with a phone. People became started to look at these pieces of glass, these slabs of glass, as a means to consume media. But in reality, they're also communications devices. And they're not just communications devices, but for many people, they're the primary communications device. So if you can find a way to produce a better communications experience, a better interaction with the web of relationships that matter to you, and do that in a compelling way while bringing on the media that everybody's come to expect on these devices, I think you can have a very successful product launch.
So REM has been losing customers, particularly in the US, but you've been gaining customers in countries, sort of Mexico, Brazil, Indonesia, a lot of these sort of other places. Is your thinking then that the people have been going away from REM and from BlackBerry in sort of the US and to a lesser extent the UK because they're getting sort of seduced by these media, these media smartphones, as I guess you might call them, or is it that they're not needing to do the tasks? I mean, it sort of sounds as though they don't want to be or don't have the same need to do the things that you're describing.
I would dispute that. I think that we see
lots,
not having a need to do it. I think we see lots and lots of people today who are carrying two devices. One, because BlackBerry is such an amazing messaging device, and it's the way that they do the things that they need to do on a daily basis to be productive and to stay in contact with people. And another is a device that is some kind of a personal use media consumption device. So I think in the marriage of those two devices, with BlackBerry 10, you're going to see a lot of those people will choose to carry one device again.
With the BlackBerry handsets, the ones that are out there now, how many of those are going to be upgradable to BB10?
None.
None at all?
Yeah. BlackBerry 7 devices simply don't have the capacity and power to be able to run BlackBerry 10.
Isn't that going to create something of a gap? I mean, it's a big sort of cutoff to make. It's rather like what Microsoft did with Windows Mobile to Windows Phone, where there simply was no conjunction between the two.
Yeah, I think that that particular I think that people are going to be making choices about which device to move on to next, right? Our view is that better to have a great modern experience on a modern platform than to try to accommodate the older platforms. There'll be an opportunity for people as they come off contract to pick up a new BlackBerry 10 device, and we're pretty convinced that a significant number of them will.
I mean, there's still a huge amount of the market to play for. In the UK, smartphone penetration hasn't quite yet hit 60%. In the US, it's around 50%, slightly below. So you've still got a huge number of people who you can persuade to buy a BlackBerry. What would be your pitch to them, given that these are the sort of the late adopters? How will you persuade them to go with you rather than, say, the Androids or the iPhones or the Windows phones?
Mm-hmm. I think you're making the presumption that we're going after the late adopter. you know, and I'm not the marketing guy for the company, so I probably shouldn't be revealing the strategy, but I don't think it's a safe assumption to say that we're going after the late adopter on this one.
Now, given that you're VP for developer operations, what are the developers telling you? You've had this interesting incentive scheme whereby you'll pay $10,000 for people who sell $1,000 of apps. Is that the right way of presenting it?
It's more of a commitment that they'll be able to earn money from the platform in the first year that they're out there. So in May of this past year at the Jam Orlando event, we unveiled a couple of different programs. One of them was the Built for BlackBerry program. The Built for BlackBerry program is a means for a developer to earn a certification which says that they've built a quality application that uses BlackBerry 10 features. And the other was the $10,000 commitment. And the 10K commitment works like this. You build us a quality application for BlackBerry and earn that Built for BlackBerry certification. Put it in the store on or before January 21st, 2013. That's the cutoff date for it. So it can be there for us at launch. And if you can earn $1,000 with that application under your own steam in the first year, then we will make up the difference between whatever you earned and $10,000 at the end of the year. And that's one of many things that we've done in the last little while that are targeted at developers.
Alex Saunders, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Alex Saunders from RIM. And you can read more about the company and the latest at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, Charles, this week is one of the most exciting events in the pre-Christmas run-up, and that is the launch of the iPad Mini. Tell me what we can expect from this new Apple device.
Well, there have been rumors for ages that Apple would get into this smaller tablet space, and there's been a lot of interest around tablets just generally because we shouldn't overlook the fact that Microsoft is also this week launching Windows 8 officially. There's a big launch in New York for that. Josh Halliday is going to be attending for us, and they've got their Surface tablet, which of course was shown off, though people didn't get the chance to go hands-on with it early in the year. And there hadn't been any pricing, even up to last week, people were still waiting for prices actually to be handed down for them. So the whole tablet space has become very interesting. Apple, of course, has really owned the 10-inch tablet space with the iPad launched in April of 2010. But more recently, Amazon and then Google with the Nexus 7 have shown that there is a viable space for the smaller tablet, for the sort of the mid-range tablet, inches along the diagonal.
But didn't Samsung have a Galaxy that served that purpose at one point?
Samsung absolutely has. Samsung has pretty much done the whole variety. They've done 7-inch, 6-inch, 5-inch, you name the inch, they've done it. And some in between, they had an 8.5-inch at one point, I think. The trouble is that Samsung is great at producing hardware, but they're not so good at doing the services side, and that is what has held them back, especially in the tablet space. Their products look great, and yet you turn them on, you go, oh yeah, it's Android again. And they've not been able, I think, to crack it in that space. Google, on the other hand, with the Nexus 7, built for them by Acer, they have a much more thought-through proposition. It's pure Android. It's not got any extra services, but it is very focused on being a Google device for getting content. So from Google Play, they show films on the front page. The idea is, you're going to read books, you're going to watch films, you're going to do a bit of music on it. Amazon, similarly with the Kindle Fire tablets, is doing the same sort of thing. It's a shortcut to the Amazon shop. I mean, basically, it's like having an Amazon app on any other tablet, except the Amazon app is always open, and it's ready to do that.
So what can the Mini offer in this? The iPad Mini offer in this space, and why, frankly, are they moving into this space? Is it because they actually are they're on the increase in the sales?
It's because there's a chance to sell things, and because as it is, they've left what's called a price umbrella below the sort of £300-£350 mark. A price umbrella exists where you have a range of products that's starting at a particular price A, but there's a big gap between A and zero. And that means that people who are smart enough can come along and they can push products into those spaces and say, okay, so we're not a gigantic tablet, but hey, listen, we're cheaper. And for a lot of people, actually, especially in these days, cheaper is better.
So if the Kindle Fire is an Amazon app in a device, and the Google system is ultimately a Google delivery device, what will the iPad Mini be? Because there's a whole lot of stuff that people can do on iPads anyway that isn't just dedicated to the Apple Store.
Think of it as basically just a big shortcut to the App Store. You know, and that's what it is. Whatever you want, you know, whatever you do on the App Store, that's what you do on the iPad Mini. Really.
But you can also do all kinds of things, can't you, for using the iPad?
Well, sure, but you can do, you know, all sorts of things on the Kindle Fire and on the Nexus 7. You know, none of these things is precluded by the form factor necessarily. I think that probably people aren't going to be, you know, doing works of art on an iPad Mini sort of size, because really it's much more about convenience, carrying around, sticking in your pocket. You know, it's not as big as the iPad, but hey, in some ways that can be a benefit. Carphone Warehouse last week, for example, said that the Nexus 7 had been their best-selling ever Android tablet. Careful to emphasize the Android there, you know, and they wouldn't, when I asked them, they wouldn't give me figures for what the ratio was of the sales of the Nexus 7 to the iPad. But, you know, it indicates there is a market there. And Apple, I think, is not stupid. You know, they're very savvy people. And, for example, it was noticeable back in the days of the iPod that, first of all, Apple started out with the hard drive iPod, which went from 5 to 10 to 20 to, you know, 30 gigabytes. And then they went with the iPod Mini. And that was actually the product which really kicked off the iPod sales. That was what went ballistic. And they did that in January 2004, followed up with the Nano in 2005, then the Shuffle, things like that. They just basically completely, they went from having the price umbrella above the original iPod to having absolute coverage and total dominance of the space. So they're really looking to do the same again.
So what can we expect then in terms of logistics and price point and release for this device?
What I'm hearing is £249 for the basic model. Not clear if that's going to be an 8 gig or a 16 gig model. That would be Wi-Fi only, obviously. Originally, I was hearing that the Mini would only be Wi-Fi, but I'm now hearing 3G and possibly 4G as well.
Okay, well, keep an ear and an eye out on the Guardian's website, on the technology website, where Josh Halliday will be covering the Microsoft launch, and I'm sure there will be some live blogging action from yourself, Charles, about the iPod, about the iPad Mini, which is being announced on the 23rd of October. So finally, Jemima Kish spoke with Ian Hogarth of Songcake back in 2009 when the idea for a music service that delivered everything you needed to know about your favorite band was still in short trousers. She revisited the company, which recently raised $6.3 million in funding, and wanted to find out what their next step is.
Ian Hogarth, lovely to have you in the studio again. How's it going at Songkick?
It's going really well. I mean, I think it's been a really exciting past couple of years, and you know, the site's grown a lot. We're now the second largest concert site in the world after Ticketmaster.com, and you know, we've released apps for iPhone, Android, and Spotify, which are now the biggest apps on those platforms for concert discovery. Done a bunch of great new partnerships with Google, with YouTube, Foursquare, Spotify, SoundCloud, Deezer, a whole host. And I feel really excited because the team is still just so hungry to innovate around concerts.
Tell us about funding as well, the big bucks.
Oh yeah, we raised a round of funding from Sequoia, who are great VC based in Silicon Valley, who backed YouTube and Google and Apple and others, and they made their first ever UK investment with Songkick.
Of how much?
Oh, of $10 million, which is an unfathomable amount of money, to be honest, if you're honest about it. And I remember when we were first starting Songkick, I couldn't even imagine that you'd ever need that amount of money to do something. And it turns out that, you know, really great technology and people to build that technology does cost a surprising amount of money when you kind of roll it over a bunch of years.
And how many people are you now?
We're now 30 people.
30 people. So we're here to talk about Detour, which is, did it almost happen by accident? Tell us what it is.
So Detour is an idea that fans can proactively pull a band to their city by pledging money to say that they would go and see them live. And it didn't really happen by accident, actually. It was an idea we discussed in the very first email we ever, you know, had about Songkick between the three of us that founded the company. And there are basically two ideas in that email. The first was, we had loads of friends who really loved music, but stopped going to concerts and would just tell us, oh man, if it was easier, I'd go to more shows. And that insight essentially has led to us spending the last 5 years of our lives building Songkick. But it is working. And now those friends of ours are going to twice as many concerts as a result of Songkick. But the other idea was actually a little bit more about people who went to a lot of concerts. And it was this idea that, you know, when you were browsing around on MySpace back in 2007, any great new band you discovered, there'd be hundreds of comments on their page saying, come to Bloomington, Indiana, or come to Sao Paulo, or come to London. And that was all that a fan could do. They could just leave a comment. And ultimately, like, when a band's livelihood, you know, depends on live music and it costs an awful lot of money to travel around the world, that's not enough to route a tour around. And so we always had this idea, well, what about if you gave the fans the chance to put money up? But I think we always felt like, you know, the first thing we needed to focus on was Songkick. And now that Songkick's got to a level of scale where we have this amazing database of music fans and people who are telling us every day which bands they want to see live, we sort of felt like it was time to kind of revisit that second idea.
So how did you work out who to sort of experiment with first?
Well, it was a bit of a combination of art and science, I suppose, because we wanted to find a band who hadn't played London before, but for whom the Songkick data, you know, the trackings data, indicated that there were a lot of fans in London who really wanted to see them live. Where the band themselves would not have gone otherwise. They just would not have gone. There wasn't promoter interest and they weren't confident enough they could go on their own accord. So that was the like science bit of it. And we've got a bunch of smart engineers who were looking at that. But the art bit of it was just our creative director, Gideon, loved this band. And he was really obsessively into them. And, you know, the band, we first did it with this band, Tycho. You know, Gideon's a brilliant, brilliant visual designer. And Tycho's actually a visual designer as well as a musician. And so Gideon had been following his poster art and stuff like this. And so when we were like, oh, one of the bands that seems like it would be a great fit for this to test with was Tycho. He was like, we're going to do that one. So we started out with Tycho and we tried to see if we could get Tycho his first ever European show through the Detour system.
And then after Tycho, we moved on to Monkeys with Miniature Cymbals.
Yeah, well, we actually did a few more in the interim, which I haven't written about yet. They all have slightly different characteristics, and I'm going to do like a series of posts about them all. But the biggest one we've done so far has been Hot Chip, and that actually occurred on Sunday night, which is why I kind of just couldn't help but write about it really after the show, because it was such a great event.
You had a really interesting conversation with the band and their management that led to that happening, didn't you?
Yeah, and it was really insightful, because the manager of the band and their agent and the band themselves have been, you know, working in live music for a good long while now. And the manager has seen tons of bands sort of tour over the past 10, 20 years. And he said, you know, as live music has become more corporate, bands just don't go to the same range of cities that they used to. And, you know, once upon a time, you'd play every single town you could in Britain and every other, you know, country you were going to. But now it's just play the standard circuits, you know, the same old cities you'd already play and the same old, you know, X brand academies and all the rest of it. And that's not necessarily a bad thing that people are now playing those places confidently. But it's sad that, like, a lot of towns have been left by the side in that process. And so we collaborated with them to try to put a show on somewhere they wouldn't ordinarily go, but where there were fans that really wanted to see them.
Is this going to be a money spinner for Songkick, or is this really just about, you know, just seeing if you could do it first?
I think it's I think we believe it actually is a really great way for us to create value for the industry and capture some value for Songkick in the process, in the form of, you know, the
capture some value. That means make lots of money, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I guess I think about this stuff like, you've got to create value and prove you can do that and be really useful to the people that you serve, the fan and the artist. And if you create value, then that's also your opportunity to capture some value and keep funding your company, not just off, you know, off VC checks, but from real revenue.
And so how's that going to work?
So basically, when we do a detour, people are pledging money for concerts that turn into real events if they're successful, and we take a percentage of the eventual kind of pledges or tickets.
Now, other companies, other startups have tried this before. I remember one, it's about 4 years ago now, the name of which escapes me. But why hasn't this worked until now?
I mean, I think that's a really great question. I suppose if you're an entrepreneur, you spend half your time thinking about timing and when the right time to try a new idea is. And, you know, this was an idea we had right at the start of Songkick, and I've always wanted to try it, but I think there are a few things that needed to happen first. The first is that, you know, we now have, you know, the second largest collection of people who love live music in the world, and they, you know, they trust Songkick as a brand to help curate their live music lives. And that means we have people where we have a trusted relationship we've established over years that we can use in partnership with music fans to try and bring bands to a city that they wouldn't have otherwise gone to. So we have the Songkick kind of audience to start out with, and that's pretty meaningful now. The second thing is, I think that the web has matured in terms of what people are willing to do. And the first thing they're willing to do is they're willing to more speculatively commit themselves to things. So things like Kickstarter and Groupon have both been examples of where people start to sort of say, you know, I'm going to put my credit card into this system, knowing not entirely certain as to what's going to occur, but because I'm excited about the thing that might occur if enough people get involved. And the second thing that's happened is that I think that self-organization has become a much bigger theme of the social web. And, you know, you've seen things like Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street and the Stop SOPA movement, where huge numbers of people have self-organized around things they believe in. And I think that, you know, the music industry spends a lot of time complaining about file sharing and whatever else, but it's easy to forget that fan is short for fanatic. And, you know, there are so many bands that I want to see live in London who haven't come here yet. And I've got like two or three that I'm specifically working on from a Detour point of view to try and bring over to London. And when you're really passionate about a band and you love their music, you know, the idea of, you know, committing in advance to say, look, if you can come over, I'll buy a ticket, that actually seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do. And I think that more and more you'll see fans figuring out how to self-organize with other fans that share their passion to make that happen.
Is this going to work best for small bands, or do you think, you know, we could lure Tom Waits?
I think we're still trying to figure that out. So far we've done it with a mix of sort of small and medium-sized bands, with Hot Chip being the biggest band we've done it with. We've got a really big one going live in early November, the biggest one we've done, actually probably the biggest crowd. It's probably going to be the biggest crowd-funded tour thing that anyone's ever done.
You have to tell us who it is.
I can't tell you who it is because I am under embargo by the band themselves. But that's going to be a pretty big deal, and I'm really excited to see how that plays out, to sort of test it on a bigger stage. But I think also, you know, one of the most exciting things about this is, you know, I've got loads of friends who are in bands, and they start to, you know, they start to take off a little bit and things go well. They get their first EP, has some good reviews, and they know they have fans in other places. But, you know, the fans are sort of 50 people here or 400 people there or 300 people here. And it's really hard for them to have the confidence to book a plane ticket and, you know, outlay that money to go to that place if the promoters aren't willing to kind of put money up. And on the promoter's side, I have a lot of sympathy as well, because, you know, the average promoter is losing money like quite regularly when concerts don't go well. And they have to take on the risk at the moment. And this Detour platform kind of enables all of that risk to be taken out of the system by allowing the fans and the artists to connect directly to make it happen. So, you know, my hope is Tom Waits can be done through the system, but, you know, we'll see.
And what happens next? I mean, ultimately, it might end up with you having to change your entire business if it really takes off. Could you see that happening?
Well, I think it's actually very analogous to what we already do. I mean, basically, fans tell us which bands they want to see live, and we try and connect them to those bands. And the moment we do that with concerts that have already been arranged, but this just enables us to, if the concert isn't there already, to help, to give the fans a way to make it happen. And so I think it's actually kind of, it's basically what the next level of what we do, as opposed to something different from what we do. So I think it's, I think if it continues to be as successful as it's been so far, it'll become an integral part of the Songkick product.
Ian, that was great. We'll look forward to seeing who your mystery band is in the beginning of November.
Yeah, it's not Tom Waits.
That was Songkick's Ian Hogarth with Jemima Kish. That's it for this week. Thank you very much to Charles Arthur for being in the studio, and to Jason Phipps over there in the glass box, Tech Weekly's fearless producer. You can find out more on these stories at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, and do drop us a line. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we are back next Tuesday. See you then.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.